Hey, good evening, everybody. We're going to begin our teaching this evening. Let's start with our motivation and really rejoice at our precious human life, our opportunity to listen to the teachings, how fortunate it is just to have encountered the Buddha Dharma, and the benefits that hearing, thinking, and meditating on it can bring not only to this life, but especially in the long term to the fulfillment of our spiritual goals, the attainment of full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So let's get in touch with that aspiration and that wish as the motivation for doing what we're doing tonight. Okay. Ding. Okay, so we had a few questions from last week. I thought I would start with those and before going into the topic for this week. Okay, so one person asked, in Buddhism it says that the mind continues on after death, but what is the mind in this sense? Is it an ultimate reality? Is it a compound of the five aggregates? Is it consciousness? How does it record karma? Okay, so the mind continues on after death, but remember the mind is not an inherently existent thing, okay? The mind exists by being merely labeled on whatever moments of clarity and awareness there are at present at that particular moment, and that the mind is something that's constantly changing, momentarily changing, never remaining the same. So don't just say, well, we don't believe in the soul, but we believe in the mind. And here's this concrete mind that just, you know, picks up out of one body, goes over and goes kerplunk into the next body, but it's the same mind and so it's the same person. Mm-mm. Okay? The mind, even now, is changing moment by moment by moment, isn't it? You know? Is there anything that exists in one moment that exists exactly in the same way in the next moment? Is there anything that you can identify as the mind in and of itself in that continuum of clarity and knowing? No. Okay. So when we say the mind goes on into the next life, it's just conventional language, okay? It's meaning that this ever-changing continuum of clear and knowing that's ability, that has the ability to perceive and engage in objects keeps on going, you know. But it's not the same from one moment to the next. And also, it's not a self. It's not a person. There is nothing about our mind that is me. We feel very strongly that, wait a minute, my mind is me. What are you talking about? My mind is me. I am my mind. I am my thoughts. Like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. But if you really examine, what is me about the mind? What is a person about the mind? Yeah. We have this strong feeling of there's me there. But what really is that me? Yeah? I mean, really, when you look at it, is there anything that's a person about the mind? Is there anything that's a person about the body? You took the body in parts and just scattered them around? Anything about a person there? No. So the mind also isn't a person. The mind simply continues on. independence upon the five aggregates. The five aggregates being the body, or form, feeling, discrimination, conditioning factors, and primary consciousnesses. Independence upon those five, we can label a person, but there's no person there. Okay, it's just what we have labeled. It's kind of like, you know, when we were kids and we used to look at the linoleum and see faces in the linoleum. Do you remember that? Yeah. Or you look somewhere and you see faces in it, you see different things. Is there a face there? No, it's just these different colors and shapes. And our mind looks at it, and our mind creates a face there and then labels face. But there's no face in those dots. Okay. Or it's similar, you know, to a photograph. Actually, a photograph's a very good example. You know, when you look, you know, on a regular photograph, it's just a bunch of dots. Or on a computer screen, it's just a bunch of pixels, isn't it? You know, and it's just dots, just all these individual dots. Isn't it? Is there anything that is, you know, the face in any of those dots? Is the collection of dots itself a face? No? There's only a face when our mind puts these things together and conceives of them, and then we go, oh, look, you know, there's a face in the computer screen. Okay? So do you see the role of the mind in conceiving and labeling something? Okay? So it's the same thing whether you talk about the person, whether you talk about the mind, whether you talk about the body. All these things exist dependently. And one way in which they're dependent is they depend upon the, you know, a mind conceiving and labeling them. Okay, that was one question somebody asked. Oh, they also asked, how does it record karma? Okay, when an action ceases, and karma just means action of body, speech, and mind. And remember, an action also isn't inherently existent. It depends on many moments, okay, and it depends on, you know, if it's a physical action, it's going to depend on the mind and on the body and on, you know, a motivation and an object and the action itself and, you know, the completion of the action. So remember, karma also is dependent. It doesn't have its own inherent essence. Yeah. But when the action itself ceases, it leaves a karmic imprint, yeah, on the mind stream. Or, according to the Prasangika, it leaves what's called a disintegratedness. Don't ask me how to say that in Spanish. Okay? What it means, it's the having ceasedness of something. Okay? So, you know, that continues on. So whether you say it in a, you know, in the way of it's the having ceasedness, or whether you say it in the way of it's an imprint, a residual energy, there's something there that continues. It said that the mind carries the karma, but again, remember, the mind is not one thing. There's many levels of mind, you know? Sometimes there's sense consciousness is functioning, or mental consciousness manifests. Sometimes we're sleeping in deep sleep. Sometimes we're waking up. Sometimes we're dreaming. There's all different kinds of consciousnesses, okay? So we're just saying the mind in general, you know, more specifically the mental consciousness, carries the karma. But it isn't like karma is this thing and the mind is a thing and they're glued together, okay? But, you know, we say the mind carries the consciousness, but when you look more closely, you also have to say that the person carries the consciousness. And the person that carries, the person carries the karma. But the person, remember, is what is merely labeled. So it's nothing that's findable. You can't pinpoint what it is that carries the karma, except it's just something merely labeled on whatever aggregates there are at that moment. Okay. But the karma is momentary, changing moment to moment to moment. Okay, the person is moment to moment by moment. Okay, so that's what carries the karma. Don't, you know, we might use the example of the mind is like a river and the karma is like a leaf that drops in and floats downstream. That's just an example. Don't get too physical about this. Thinking like, okay, there's a person and there's a karma and you know, they go along. Yeah. Don't confuse examples with real things. Okay, so that was one question. Then another question was, are the base and the label the same thing? Okay. And this person was saying it might be easier to determine that in the case of an object, but what about something like a disease or a problem, and they gave the example of anorexia. Okay? And are we supposed to refute the base? Okay, so it's important to understand this, yeah? When we things exist by being merely labeled, okay, independence upon a base and a mind that conceives and labels them. The base, if, for example, okay, we have a pear. Well, the pear is actually the labeled object, isn't it? Yeah. What's the base? The base is this kind of yellowish, greenish skin and this white stuff inside, and the atoms and molecules at the base, or you could say the seeds of the base, or you could say the core plus the fleshy part plus the skin are the base, you know, however you want to describe this stuff, okay? And in dependence upon that, yeah, we put the piece together and we say, oh, there's a pear. Yeah. So the pear is the labeled object, and this thing, however we wish to describe it in terms of its molecular structure or different parts or whatever, is the base. Yeah. The base and the labeled object, they depend on each other, because this can't be the base of the label pear unless you have the pair that's labeled in dependence upon the space. Okay? So this thing, these atoms and molecules may exist first, but it doesn't become a pair until we call it a pair. Okay? So we have the labeled object and the base. The problem is that we think the base is the labeled object. In other words, we think this thing is a pear. Okay? Because if somebody says, what's that in your hand? You say, it's a pear. Okay? So that's conventional way of speaking. It's a pear. It is a pear. But it is a pear? If you analyze, what about this is a pear? Yeah, what about this is a pear? Does it have its own pair essence? And isn't it a pair simply because we agreed to give that sound, pair, a meaning that refers to this kind of thing? But is this a pair? Is it a pair inside? If you broke it up, is a pair going to come out? Okay. What about this thing is a pair? Is the skin a pair? Is the core a pair? Is the juice a pair? You know, are the carbon cells a pair? Are the nitrogen cells a pair? Well, when we look and we find something in here that's identifiable as a pair, no, we can't. Okay, the pair exists just by being labeled. It exists nominally, conventionally, dependently, relatively. Okay, but it exists. But it doesn't exist with its own essence. So we aren't, when we're meditating on emptiness, we're not refuting the label. We're not refuting the base. Okay? And there's nothing wrong with calling this thing a pair if we all understand what we're referring to. Yeah, it's certainly easier to say, you know, bring a pair than it is to say, bring a thing that's about 4.5 inches tall with this kind of yellowish skin with some brown dots, that has a core in the middle and some white stuff inside that's juicy, but it goes brown when you cut it. I mean, you know, I mean, it's much easier to say, bring a pear, isn't it? Okay? So we just use pear as some nominal convention. We're not refuting pear, you know, as a labeled object. We're not refuting the base. What we are refuting is that this thing is a pair from its own side without depending on anything else. That's what we're refuting. We're refuting that this thing has an inherent nature that is a pair. That's what it's empty of some kind of inherent nature. Some kind of existence under its own power. But on the conventional level, that this is a pair, no problem. You know? And that this thing is the basis of the label pair, no problem. Okay? Now, with the example that this person said of anorexia, okay? The basis of the label anorexia is this labeled object. The basis is a bunch of symptoms or a bunch of characteristics. Okay? So the characteristic of feeling that you're fat and hating your body and eating and then making yourself vomit or eating and then taking laxatives to make the food go down. All those bunches of behaviors. Yeah, and they're each individual actions, individual behaviors. Together, we look at it and we say anorexia. But anorexia isn't a thing, you know. It's just a label that we give to a certain group of characteristics. And that's what I was saying. Sometimes, you know, when we're sick, if we think of the disease that we have as an inherently existent thing, then we get very afraid and panicky and upset. You know, I have cancer. You know, but what is cancer? Yeah. is cancer one cell? Is it the nucleus of that cell? Is it a virus? Is it a bunch of cells together? Is it the atoms of the cells? You know, when you look, it's just that there's a certain thing, you know, there's a certain things together that function in a certain way, and then we just give it the label cancer. Sometimes if you think of a disease like that, then it seems much more spacious, yeah, rather than I have this thing that's afflicting me. Okay, you get what I mean? There just seems to be more space in the mind. Okay, so the same thing with anorexia. It's just something that exists by being labeled. It doesn't have an inherent existence in and of itself. Okay, and then there was one more question. We will get to the talk for tonight. Okay, how is it that practitioners of the fundamental vehicle can attain liberation if they hold on to the views of the lower schools as superior? Okay, so we call the views, the Vaibhasika and Sao Tantrika school, the views of the fundamental vehicle, and the Chittamatra and the Madhyamaka as the views of the Mahayana, you know, tradition, Mahayana vehicle. So the question is if you are a practitioner of the fundamental vehicle, how do you attain liberation if you hold the Vaibhasika and Satantrika views? There is a difference between being the holder of a view of a fundamental vehicle and being a practitioner of the fundamental vehicle. They're different. Okay? So we just went through what the schools are. You know, Vaibhasika, Satantrika, fundamental vehicle, philosophical tenet systems, Chittamatra, Madhyamaka, Mahayana philosophical tenet systems. In terms of practitioners, you know, you become a fundamental vehicle or a Mahayana vehicle practitioner depending on your motivation, not depending on your tenet system. Okay? So if you aspire for liberation from cyclic existence for yourself, and that's it, then you're a practitioner of the fundamental vehicle. If you aspire for full Buddhahood, then you're a practitioner of the Mahayana vehicle. You could be a practitioner of the fundamental vehicle and hold Madhyamaka philosophical tenets. Okay, why not? Why not? Practitioners of the fundamental vehicle attain liberation. In order to attain liberation, you have to refute the inherent existence of persons and phenomena. What school is it that teaches you how to refute the inherent existence of persons and phenomena? It's the Madhyamaka school. Okay? So you can be a practitioner of the fundamental vehicle and hold Madhyamaka tenets, no problem. You could be a Madhyamaka, or you could be a holder of a Mahayana practitioner, and sometimes you may not even hold a Buddhist tenet system. You know, because sometimes our minds are so chock-a-block full of, you know, defilements that our philosophical belief is like way off. Yeah, so no reason to get arrogant. You know, oh, I'm a Mahayanist. Well, you know, you could still hold a Vaibhasika or Satantrika view. Yeah, or if you're a very dull faculty, you could even hold a non-Buddhist view. Yeah. Okay, In which case, you're not going to get enlightened. Yeah, you have to definitely change your view and have a Madhyamaka view. Okay, so you see what I mean? And also, you know, within the Pali canon, there are certain passages where the Buddha did refer to the Madhyamaka view, you know, according to the, you know, the Tibetans looking at it. They say, you know, certain passages. There's one very beautiful one. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya. I can't remember which sutta. But it says the form is like a bubble, a foam. What is it? You know, form is like a bubble and feelings are like a foam and, you know, things like this. I should have brought the whole quote in. But look, going through each of the aggregates and saying how it's something insubstantial. You know, like the core of a plantain tree, like a bubble, like a piece of, you know, like foam, like a mirage, stuff like that. So it said that that passage in the Pali Canon is actually talking about the selflessness of phenomena. You know, the Madhyamaka view of the selflessness of phenomena. Okay? And there's some other passages where they say the same thing, that, you know, in the Pali Canon they're teaching the Madhyamaka view. Okay, so those are the questions from last week. Hope you don't have more questions now that I answered the question. Okay, so what we're going to go into this week is different steps for delving into emptiness, kind of what we need to do in order to cultivate special insight into emptiness. Okay. And by the way, special insight or vipassana, it isn't always into emptiness. It could be, there's a worldly kind of vipassana too. So here we're talking about the vipassana, the special insight, where the object is the emptiness of inherent existence. So what we need there is, first, we need to gain firm convictions in the fault and the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Okay, so we really need to understand that cyclic existence is a hellhole. As long as we think cyclic existence is a nice playground, why realize emptiness? Yeah, you have no motivation to realize emptiness, because it's, you know, why? If samsara is nice, you go out and enjoy yourself. Why stress out about realizing emptiness? Okay, so we have to really think about the different teachings taught in the first two noble truths, okay, the truth of dukkha or suffering and the causes of it, and really develop conviction in the faults and disadvantages of cyclic existence. Then second, we need to really seek out the root cause of cyclic existence. In other words, if we're in this predicament, what is the root cause of it? Okay, what if you keep tracing back and back and back, what do you finally find as the cause of our being in cyclic existence? Okay, so we take rebirth due to karma, we create karma due to afflictions. Afflictions come out of this fundamental misunderstanding or misapprehension of the nature of phenomena that we call self-grasping ignorance. So we trace the root of samsara back to the self-grasping ignorance. Okay, so that's the second thing we need to do. Yeah, so we do that when we meditate on the 12 links of dependent arising. Okay, third thing we need to do is to ascertain that the way that ignorance, and particularly the view of the perishing aggregates, or jitta, which is self-grasping of our own particular self as inherently existent, that this way that ignorance and the view of the perishing aggregates apprehend things is totally incorrect. Okay? So you have to see the disadvantages of cyclic existence, trace its root cause to ignorance, and then see that the way ignorance apprehends things is totally erroneous. Because if ignorance apprehended things in a correct way, then first of all, there's no need to get rid of ignorance, because it sees reality. Yeah, if ignorance saw reality, why do we call it ignorance? Okay, if ignorance didn't misapprehend things, no reason to call it ignorance. Okay, so but we have to really understand how ignorance apprehends. You know, what does it mean to apprehend inherent existence or to grasp an inherent existence? Okay? And then, through doing that, through really seeing that the way ignorance apprehends is wrong, okay, that's the way to develop our wisdom, okay? And then the fourth thing we need to do is, having ascertained the correct view, which is that things are empty of inherent existence, in other words, the total opposite of how ignorance apprehends things, then the fourth thing we need to do is to familiarize our mind with that view. Okay? So to really come back to it again and again and again and again and retrain our mind to see things in a correct way. Because yeah. Right now our mind is very familiar with seeing things in the wrong way. And we know, just in terms of ordinary habits, they're very difficult to break, aren't they? And these are even just habits of this life, like smoking or, you know, overeating or drinking or idle talk or whatever. You know, just even habits of this life are hard to break. Well, we have beginningless time of a habit of grasping an inherent existence. Is that habit going to be easy to break? No, it's going to take some time. We're going to need to familiarize ourselves again and again and again with the correct view. Okay? So those are the four things we need to do. That's kind of like an outline. How do we gain that correct view? Yeah. How do we go from the wrong view of ignorance to the correct view of the wisdom realizing emptiness? Okay. There's a process that we go through. Yeah. We start out with the wrong view. Yeah. And you know, we have an innate wrong view that we've been born with, and then we have an acquired wrong view that we've learned from incorrect philosophies and psychologies. Okay, so we start out with that wrong view. I mean, our innate wrong view is we just, you know, especially in emotional situations, everything seems inherently existent. You know, there's a real me. A real me sitting here. With my real needs and my real wants and my real likes and dislikes and my real rules of the universe. And everything seems very real, and all the phenomena out there are real. I'm living in a world of objective entities that all have their own, you know, essence. That's how we perceive things. That's how we grasp things to exist. Okay, and then dependent upon that innate grasping, then we develop acquired grasping by developing all sorts of philosophies. So in the West, we have the philosophy of a soul. Okay, there's a real thing that's me. It's called the soul. It's not the body. It's not the mind. But it's the essence of me. The soul. And when I die, the body decays, the mind, you know, who knows what happens to it, but my soul can continues on and is immortal. Or you talk of a higher self, if you're into New Age, you know, there's a higher self. Yeah. But again, it's the essence of me-ness, the thing that's really me. Okay, you strip down my likes, you strip down my dislikes, you strip down all my opinions, but you come to the core thing that's really me, that makes me a special entity that's different from everybody else, that's immutable and unchangeable and never disintegrates. Okay. We think like that, don't we? We grew up with those kind of views. We were taught that way of thinking. Okay? Those are acquired wrong views. Yeah? But they're really deep, aren't they? You know, if you learn certain things as a kid, then you just believe them. And so those aren't even the innate ones that are really hard to eliminate. They're the acquired ones, which are in comparison easy to eliminate. But as Kendra Rinpoche said when he was here last time, in some ways the acquired wrong views are more insidious because they have reasons behind them. The innate wrong views is just there, you know. Even the kitties have them. Even the voles and the mosquitoes have them. Those innate wrong, you know, innate ignorance, innate wrong views. But us, we develop whole philosophies and write books on them and get PhDs dependent on them. Yeah? And make ourselves famous dependent on them. And, you know, and so in some ways, because we have all these reasons. You know, oh, there's got to be a soul. Why? Because God created it. There's got to be a higher self. Why? Because I feel that there's something inside me that's just inherently pure, that's forever me. And then somebody's going to go, isn't that the Buddha nature? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So what's the difference? What's the difference between Buddha nature and a higher self and a pure soul? What's the difference? When we say Buddha nature, do we really have the correct view of Buddha nature? Or are we one of these Mahayana practitioners who don't even have a Buddhist tenet system that we believe in? Are we still believing in a soul but calling it Buddha nature? Okay, we got to be careful here. Okay, so we start out with the wrong view. Then we begin to hear teachings. And this is why hearing teachings is so important. You know, because on our own, with all of our wrong views, it's going to be very difficult to discover a correct view without hearing any teachings from anybody. Okay? So we have to depend on teachers and on teachers who have the correct view. Yeah. Then we hear the teachings. And then some doubt comes in the mind. Okay? So there's three kinds of doubt. The doubt inclined towards the wrong view. The doubt that's in the middle, maybe there's inherent existence, maybe there's not. And then the doubt that's inclined to the right view. Maybe there's no inherent existence. Yeah, just maybe. I'm not sure yet. Okay. Shall we go from wrong view to the doubt inclined to the negative, to the wrong view, to the middling doubt, to the doubt inclined towards the correct view? And we do this by hearing teachings and thinking about them. So we have to understand what inherent existence is. If things existed inherently, how would they be? You know, could they exist inherently? You know, is there a way to prove inherent existence? Or when we look for inherent existence, do we actually find it's the emptiness of inherent existence? Okay. So we go from the wrong view to doubt. Then as we learn more, we think more, Yes, we have to really think about the teachings. It's not just hearing the words. We have to think about them. And not just one time or two times, but, you know, think about them, discuss about them, get a clear understanding, make sure that even on a verbal level we know the words right, and on a conceptual level we have the concepts correct. Yeah? And then we go from doubt to what's called correct assumption. So this is kind of a general correct understanding. Yeah? Like, oh yeah, you know, things can't have an inherent essence, because if things have an inherent essence, you would be able to find it. And you should be able to find it either in the basis of designation or as something separate from the basis of designation. But you can't find it in either place. So, yeah, makes sense. Things aren't inherently existent. So you have some kind of correct understanding, yeah, but it's not really in your heart. Yeah, it's just you kind of got it, but it doesn't, you know, and it does impact you. It's certainly better than having the wrong view, but it hasn't really gone powy and woken you up. Okay, then you familiarize yourself with that correct assumption, yeah, for a long time. So from wrong view to doubt to correct assumption. And then at a certain point you get an inference, okay? And an inferential understanding is very, very powerful, because it knows irrefutably. Okay, it knows irrefutably that it's totally impossible for things to exist inherently. Okay? So it knows that totally, and that kind, it's called an inference. And usually when we hear inference, we think of logic and reasoning and intellectual blah, blah, blah. But this isn't just intellectual blah, blah, blah. This is like really getting it, you know, it's really getting it that, oh boy, I am dependent. Oh my goodness. Yeah, everything about me is dependent. And if something is dependent, it lacks an inherent essence. Oh my goodness, you know, I mean, you really get it. Okay, so that inference can have a very, you know, it can be a very profound experience. It can really shake you up. Yeah. So you have the correct view. You irrefutably know. You know, you're never going to backslide now to a wrong view or to a doubt. You know, whereas when you have the correct assumption, you know, if somebody comes along, because we're kind of dumb, if somebody comes along and makes a big case for the soul and the higher self and this thing that's really you, get in touch of it with not for $99.99, you know, we're going to buy it, because we don't have irrefutable conviction. Yeah. But when you have an inference, it's irrefutable. Okay, you're not going to go backwards. You are at that point apprehending the emptiness of true existence, if you have, you know, meditation ability at that point, which hopefully you do. Okay, so you can abide in meditation on the emptiness of true existence, because you have some degree of concentration and meditative ability, but you're perceiving emptiness through the veil of what's called a meaning generality, okay? Sometimes it's translated as mental image, but that's not a good translation. It's more like a general image, a general idea. A meaning generality is a conceptual understanding of something. It's what you perceive when you have a conceptual understanding, which is not the exact thing, but you've conflated all the different attributes of that, and you're perceiving a general, the generality of the thing, okay? So that's what you're apprehending in meditation when you have that conventional realization, that inferential realization. As you meditate more and more and more and more, okay, and as your samadhi gets deeper, and as your ability to probe the nature of reality while still in samadhi gets deeper, at some point you wear away that veil of the meaning generality, and the mind directly perceives emptiness. Okay? So that direct perception of emptiness, it's done with the mental consciousness. It's not done with your visual or auditory or any of your sense consciousnesses. You perceive emptiness directly, and you perceive it non-dually. In other words, at that time of the direct perception, there's no appearance of subject and object. There's no appearance of inherent existence. There's no appearance of a meaning generality. There's no appearance of conventional phenomena. And there's no appearance of difference, of anything, of two different things being different from each other. Okay? So it's totally non-dual. Now, when I think about that, yeah, just apprehending something non-dually. Have you ever done that in your life? You know, when I really think of it, like, you know, because it's easy to spout, oh, that's non-duality. But what in the world would it feel like to perceive things non-dually? And somebody's going to say, it feels like you're one with it. Well, if you're in meditation thinking to yourself, I'm one with everything, you are not perceiving non-duality. Because there's an I and a non-duality that you're perceiving. Okay? There's a big I that's one with everything else. As long as there's any perception of some kind of I that's one with everything, you're not in non-duality. You know, you're having an unusual experience, you know, which can be, it can give you some confidence in the path or whatever. But that's not a direct perception of emptiness. Okay? And I say that because, you know, we can have all sorts of incredible experiences, can't we? You know? And that's why I think it's very helpful to study the Dharma. Because if you learn these kinds of things, then you can check your own experience. And if there's the thought of the I has dissolved and I'm one with the universe, you've missed it. Okay. So you've gone from wrong view to doubt to correct assumption to inference to direct perception. Okay? That's how the mind, yeah, develops this understanding. Okay. When we use the term the realization of emptiness, just the term realize emptiness, it can refer to either an inferential, conceptual realization, or it can refer to a direct perception. So, you know, just be aware of that, that when we have, say, realization of emptiness, it doesn't always mean direct. It could include, you know, through this inference with the, where you're perceiving the meaning generality of emptiness. Okay, now that brings us into a whole discussion of subjects and objects, okay, which is quite interesting. If we had studied low-rig mind and awareness before. You'd have some background in this. But I just want to go through it just kind of, you know, in a general way, because it will help you in your studies of trying to figure out what emptiness is. So there's many different ways of categorizing mind. Yeah. One way of categorizing it is into conceptual minds and non-conceptual minds. Okay? That's one way. And I found this personally quite helpful to try and be mindful of. In other words, when do I have a conceptual mind and when do I have a non-conceptual mind? Okay. Non-conceptual minds apprehend the object directly. So non-conceptual minds are, for example, you know, when my visual consciousness sees the black color of the phone, that's non-conceptual. When my ear, my auditory consciousness hears the sound of the music, that's non-conceptual. When you smell something, okay, your olfactory consciousness is apprehending that odor non-conceptually. When you taste food, yeah, your gustatory consciousness, they call it your tongue consciousness, apprehends it non-conceptually. When we touch something, the hardness, the roughness, the smoothness, you know, these things, our tactile consciousness is apprehending non-conceptually. Yeah. Then, in terms of our mental consciousness, yeah, in us ordinary beings, most of our mental consciousnesses are conceptual. Whenever we're thinking, that's conceptual, isn't it? Okay, when we're thinking, we're imagining, we're planning, we're daydreaming, we're remembering the past, all of those things are conceptual. Yeah. What does conceptual mean? It means that we're not apprehending the object directly. In fact, the object doesn't even have to exist for us to have a conceptual understanding of it. You know, like when we remember something, that event is in the past, it no longer exists, but we can remember it. When we think about a person, okay, they don't even need to be in the room. They don't even need to still be alive. We can still think about them. Okay? So while the direct perceivers apprehend the object itself, yeah, the conceptual minds, yeah, which are mental consciousnesses, the sense consciousnesses don't ever perceive things conceptually. They're always direct. Okay? Direct and non-conceptual mean the same thing here. So, but our mental consciousness creates an image of an object or this meaning generality. Yeah? A generality that conflates all the different characteristics of something together. Okay, so for example, yeah, if I say think of pizza, yeah, do you have an image in your mind of pizza? Mm-hmm. That image in your mind, is there anything external that corresponds exactly to it? No, because your image of pizza is a result of all the different experiences you've had with pizza and your preferences, and then you've created your image of pizza. You get what I mean? Yeah? That image of pizza, can you eat it? No. Yeah? You can't eat it. It doesn't function as real pizza. Okay, so when we talk about conceptual consciousnesses, they are mistaken in the sense that what's appearing to them seems to be the real thing, but it's not. Our mind's confused about it. Okay. It's like, you know, if we sit and think about pizza long enough, we'll start salivating, won't we? Yeah? Or if you think about somebody who said something cruel to you, you can get angry right away. Person's not even here. What are you apprehending at that moment? A meaning generality of the person. Okay, you are not apprehending that person. They're nowhere in that room. It's totally a conceptual consciousness apprehending this meaning generality that the mind has created, which is a mixture of many different contacts we've had with that person. But it's not at all anything objective, you know, because we're just picking out a few details of the person, creating that image, and then getting furious at it, you know. When we're practicing thought training, we pick out other details, create another image, and, you know, develop loving kindness towards it. Okay. But the meaning generality that's appearing to that conceptual consciousness is not the actual object. Okay? Even though that's what's appearing to that conceptual consciousness. Okay? Now, when we talk about direct perceivers, we have sense direct perceivers. We have mental direct perceivers, for example, in the case of clairvoyance. Somebody mentally knows somebody else's mind. And we have something called yogic direct perceivers. And those are consciousnesses that have arisen due to meditation in which we can directly perceive, for example, impermanence, or we directly perceive the emptiness of inherent existence. Okay? But a lot of things, you know, we like to realize emptiness, we have to go through the conceptual understanding first to get the right view, and then tear that away to get to the actual emptiness that is apprehended non-dually by the direct mental perceiver. Okay? Then there's different kinds of objects. But I think this is a good place to pause. We got through the subject side. We'll do the object side next week. Maybe we have time for a couple of questions. Yeah.
I have a question. When you were describing, and I think of pizza, mm-hmm. when you actually look at if there was pizza in front of you, mm-hmm. how much of that is a direct perception, and how much of it does that trigger a non-direct perception? I mean, is there that happens split seconds, or uh-huh. is it?
Okay, so this is a very good question. When the pizza's in front of you, how much of that is direct perception, and how much is it conception? Yeah? This is a very interesting thing for you to explore in your own experience. And I really highly recommend this. This is a mindfulness practice of looking at your own experience and what is non- you know, conceptual, direct experience, and what is going on in my mind when I'm eating this pizza. Okay? Because the conceptions about the pizza start very quickly, don't they? And what's very interesting is before you eat, look at the food. Do you have an idea of how you think it's going to taste? We sure do, don't we? Then put a spoonful in your mouth and ask yourself, does what I'm experiencing directly with my gustatory consciousness, how does that correspond with the meaning generality that of the food that I was apprehending before I tasted it? That food, the meaning generality, the way I expected it to taste. What was the correlation between what I expected and what I'm getting? Yeah, extremely interesting. Yeah, and start watching. Go through your day and really watch, when am I having direct perception? When am I having conceptual consciousnesses? And it's fascinating to watch how, you know, for example, you know, I think we've all had the experience of you meet somebody and you take an instant like or an instant dislike to them. If you watch your experience very carefully, you know, it's like you're seeing color and shape and such, so on and so forth. And then the mind says, that's the person. And then you associate it with somebody else that you knew in the past. Or you associate it with an image of an attractive looking person that you have in your mind. Or there's some association going on in there. And then the mind says, oh, very nice, I like them. Or you associate them, maybe their voice sounds like the voice of somebody who you don't like. Then when you hear their voice automatically, it's like hearing the voice of the other person. You're projecting it on the person who's in front of you and taking a dislike of them. Okay? That is all conceptual consciousness. Yeah? All of our opinions, all of our preferences, all these things are conceptual consciousnesses. So it's very fascinating to watch throughout the day, you know, how these conceptual consciousnesses make attachment arise, make anger arise, make craving or resentment or arrogance or any of these things arise. That's all conceptual. Okay? So, for example, when we get arrogant, I'm better than somebody, you know. I can set the table better than other people. Or I can meditate better than other people. Or I can play golf better than other people. Where does that come from? Is that a direct perception? Is that a direct perception? Yeah? No, it's not at all. It's the mind taking previous direct perceptions, putting them into a generic image or meaning generality, interacting with this image that we've created and saying, oh, then I must be better. Yeah? It has nothing to do with reality. Nothing. Zero. Okay. And you'll notice this. We've all had the experience of sitting in meditation and you remember a person from years ago and you sit in that meditation and you get so angry. Yeah. Or even, you know, whatever it is, even something that seems to be happening now, we get angry at it. It's all concept. All mental concept. Yeah? So it's really fascinating. Spend some time looking at what is direct perception and what is, you know, what am I knowing by concept? Okay? Now, concept does play a role. I mean, we're all having conceptual minds right now. When you listen to Dharma teachings, as soon as you're talking with words and concept, you know? So words and concepts do have a place, and they are a good tool. Okay? But it's also helpful to realize that just because we're using words and concepts, we're not necessarily having a direct perception. We're not having a direct perception of something. And that sometimes the way we create this meaning generality of the object can be an error. But we confuse the meaning generality with the real object and think they're the same thing. And that's why we get mad at a person who isn't even in the room. Okay? So some conceptual consciousnesses are really beneficial when we're, you know, hearing and thinking about the Dharma. That use of conceptual consciousness is very good. And in fact, it's the way we have to go in order to realize emptiness. You can't start out with a direct perception of emptiness because we have no clue what it is. Okay? So hearing teachings, thinking about it, that's all concept. That's fine. Okay? We have to learn how to think correctly. But a lot of our conceptual thoughts are on Mars. You know? And so that's why, you know, our emotions, they're all of these strong emotions, like, you know, attachment, anger, these things, they're all conceptual consciousnesses. We call them a feeling. You don't understand my feeling. I feel really angry, you know? It's a conceptual consciousness. Yeah. Or, you know, what's very interesting is how we say, you don't understand my feeling. I feel so left out. I feel excluded. Okay, we say that, don't we? Can you feel excluded? Is excluded emotion, an emotion? No. I think I am excluded. Therefore, I feel hurt or angry. But you know, lots of times when we interact with people, we say, I feel excluded. But what we're really saying is, you're excluding me. Yeah? It's very interesting to try and get in touch with what we're really feeling without making it a thought we have about what somebody else is doing to us. Yeah? I feel insulted. Okay? Is feeling insulted an emotion? No, I think somebody is insulting me. I think somebody is insulting me. It's a conceptual consciousness. Yeah? When I think somebody's insulting me, then I feel hurt. Then I feel angry. But you can't really feel insulted. Okay? Very interesting, you know, to really look sometimes the way we describe our emotions and see if it's a feeling, if it's a genuine emotion, or if it's a thought. And then even if it's a genuine emotion, you know, it's all depending on concept. And in this particular thing, what we call inappropriate attention, which we'll get into a little bit later. Yeah?
When you talk about direct perception in an ordinary way, it's usually about sense consciousness. In other words, the way we can think about it is that the sense consciousness you can imagine there not being a lot of fabrication around the when I'm feeling or tasting, we can kind of roll back the consciousness of that and kind of get an idea of the direct. But a direct perception of emptiness is like sense consciousness has things work around things that are concrete.
Right.
And emptiness is not.
Right.
So there seems like there's this bridge, you know, to get from this.
Yeah, well, right. Well, sense direct perceivers, they know, you know, color and all these kinds of things. The mental direct perceiver, that's the yogic direct perception of emptiness, knows emptiness. The senses cannot know emptiness. Okay? So to get this mental direct perceiver of emptiness, we first have to start out with this thing of wrong view to doubt to correct assumption to inference using conceptual consciousnesses. And then eventually shedding the veil of the meaning generality and directly perceiving emptiness.
See, you know, the sense consciousnesses are accessible. They're sort of innately accessible to the cat and the ant and the people. They have these innate direct.
Direct perception. Yogic direct perceivers need to be deliberately cultivated. We don't have them now. Okay, we have a mental consciousness now. We don't have yogic direct perceivers. They need to be cultivated. Okay.